content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the April 30th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a scene from Afghanistan. In the background, you can see some of the rugged mountains. There's a small hut, and flying over is looks like a military helicopter. In the foreground is a Afghani couple, a man looks like his wife and a small child in her arms. Concerned looks on their faces, and the title is Leaving Afghanistan, the implication of Biden's decision to end 20 years of war. And I believe that story shows up on our controversy of the week. But our first main story is Chauvin convicted of murder and Floyd's death. What happened? Civil rights leaders and black Americans expressed relief and hope for a new era of police accountability this week after former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was convicted of murdering George Floyd in a case that launched worldwide protest and a national reckoning with racial injustice. Jurors deliberated just 10 hours before finding Chauvin guilty of second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter for kneeling on the handcuffed Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. The act was caught by a bystander in a wrenching cell phone video that was viewed by millions and became the central piece of evidence in the case. Believe your eyes. What you saw, you saw, prosecutor Steve Schleicher told the jury in his summation. Prosecutors called dozens of witnesses during the 3-week trial, including bystanders who spoke of their anguish at watching Floyd's life snuffed out as he pleaded, "I can't breathe," and medical experts who refuted the defense's claim that heart trouble and drug use caused his death. In a break with the blue wall of silence, Minneapolis police officials testified that Chauvin's restraint of Floyd was excessive and violated his training and department protocols. Looking stunned, Chauvin was led from the courtroom in handcuffs. After the verdict was read, he faces up to 75 years in prison. Black Americans hailed the verdict as a landmark moment of accountability for police after scores of high-profile cases in which officers who killed blacks were acquitted or faced no charges. "It feels like a new day in America," said B.J. Wilder, one of many who celebrated outside the convenience store where Floyd was arrested for allegedly passing a counterfeit $20 bill. "It's actually recognizing black humanity. The case sends a clear message we hope is heard clearly in every city and every state," said Floyd family attorney Benjamin Crump. President Biden called the verdict a giant step forward. He urged the Senate to pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, a House-approved bill that would ban chokeholds, require law enforcement officers to undergo training on racial profiling and de-escalation, and make it easier to pursue police misconduct charges. "This can be a moment of significant change," Biden said. What the editorial said. "Now a nation that was holding its breath for justice can exhale," said the Minneapolis Star Tribune. "In one of the most significant racial justice cases in U.S. history, 12 jurors weighed the evidence, and justice was truly served. It means that as senseless and brutal as Floyd's death was, it was not in vain." The searing video of his agonized final moments as an indifferent Chauvin ignored his pleas opened millions of eyes, hearts, and minds to what decades of racism have wrought. Our criminal justice system has been vindicated, said the Wall Street Journal. The verdict by a multiracial jury shows that a police officer who misuses his power can be brought to justice. In fact, the justice system performed more admirably than the opportunist who condoned violent protest and exploited Floyd's killing for political purposes by portraying all cops as racist. What the columnist said. This shouldn't feel so much like a victory, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, but it does. The jurors ignored the coded language the defense predictably used to depict Floyd as a dangerous black criminal whose ingestion of drugs gave him superhuman strength. Instead, they saw him as a human being. To see that happen in this historical trial is a tremendous relief and, one hopes, a beginning. Chauvin has grounds for an appeal thanks to the leftist provocateurs who lobbed rhetorical bombs into the trial, said Andrew McCarthy in the New York Post. First, the unhinged Democratic Congresswoman Maxine Waters goaded protesters to get more confrontational if Chauvin wasn't convicted, a clear incitement to violence. Then came Biden's stunning statement during jury deliberations that he was praying for the right verdict. How could Waters and Biden so blatantly disregard due process and the presumption of innocence, the pillars of our justice system? One murderous cop was found guilty, but his conviction alters nothing about the system that protected him through years of abusive behavior, said Adam Serwer in TheAtlantic.com. There will be more Derek Chauvins, and next time there may not be a brave bystander with a cell phone to bear unimpeachable witness. Still, this is a moment of rare hope for millions of Americans, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. One black man's life did matter in this case, and the aggressive prosecution and decisive verdict validated a social and political movement that sent citizens of all ethnicities into the streets during a pandemic to demand justice. The case is a chance for Americans to take a turn in the right direction, said Floyd's nephew, Brandon Williams. The question is, will we seize it by pursuing real police reform? And our controversy of the week, as we alluded to in the with the cover drawing, Afghanistan. Is Biden ending the forever war too soon? Joe Biden just made the biggest decision of his young presidency, said the Washington Post in an editorial, and the consequences are likely to be ugly. Against the advice of his generals, Biden last week announced an unconditional withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Afghanistan before September 11th, ending the longest war in U.S. history by the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks that triggered it. In the short term, the move will probably spare the United States further costs and lives, but it will almost certainly be a disaster for the country's 39 million people, and in particular, its women. Withdrawing our tiny force of 3,500 troops, who haven't suffered a combat death since 2020, makes it likely, if not inevitable, that the Taliban will regain control of Afghanistan and reverse the years of political, economic, and social progress that cost the U.S. more than $2 trillion and more than 2,000 lives. All Americans share Biden's frustration, said Jonah Goldberg in TheDispatch.com. As he said last week, when will it be the right moment to leave? One more year? Two more years? 10 more years? But when the potential cost of leaving so outweigh the minimal cost of staying, it's foolish to put feelings over facts. The cost of staying aren't as minimal as they look, said Michael Brendan Doherty in NationalReview.com. U.S. combat deaths have stopped largely because the Trump administration signed a deal last year with the Taliban, promising full withdrawal by May 1st. Attacks on our troops will likely resume when that deadline passes. As for the risks of leaving, the Taliban already act with impunity in most of Afghanistan. We do not have the ability to transform Afghans' traditional society outside of Kabul. So what is the point of staying indefinitely? It was arrogant to believe we could transform the graveyard empires, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com, and it's time to come home. Afghanistan may never be a modern liberal democracy, said Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe, but our intervention there has immensely improved the lives of countless Afghan civilians who were rescued from the Islamist hell of Taliban rule. When we leave, girls and women will again be flogged or killed if they leave their homes alone, work, or attend school. As for the talk of a forever war, let's remember that we've kept far more troops in South Korea and Germany for more than 50 years. When we pulled out of Iraq, on the other hand, it opened the door to ISIS and several years of bloody horror there and around the world. Biden wants to focus U.S. power where it can be most effective, said Peter Beinart in peterbeinart.substack.com, and that's no longer Afghanistan. Despite al-Qaeda's success against a somnolent U.S. on 9/11, the terrorist group was a small ragtag enemy, and the war on terrorism was never the world historical struggle we thought it was. The Biden administration wants to clear the decks to focus on what it sees as the next great power conflict, with China. For Americans who served in Afghanistan, said Don LaMothe and Alex Horton in the Washington Post, the pullout will bring a flood of torn emotions. Tyler Burdick, 40, who lost both legs in the Helmand province, said that while he reluctantly supports Biden's decision, it means a lot of guys got hurt and a lot of guys got killed, and it was all for nothing. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for giant steps. After NASA successfully flew a tiny helicopter named Ingenuity above the surface of Mars, the Micro Chopper, which is part of the Perseverance rover mission, stayed aloft for just 39 seconds. But project manager Mimi Ong says, "We are going to take very bold flights and take high risks." It was a good week for megafauna, with reports that a suspected rhinoceros poacher in South Africa was trampled to death by elephants while trying to flee game wardens. It was a good week for hidden deaths after Joy Chapman, 52, of British Columbia, set a new Guinness World Record for the lowest note ever sung by a female. Chapman descended a scale to a deeply guttural C1. 33.57 hertz. It's not even my lowest note, Chapman boasted afterward. But it was a bad week for government transparency after William Amos, a Canadian member of Parliament, forgot that his Zoom camera was active and removed all his clothes during an online meeting. Amos later apologized to colleagues for the unintentional distraction. It was a bad week for Kitch. After the recent six-day blockage of the Suez Canal has worsened the UK's already desperate shortage of garden gnomes. Countless gnomes are still stuck in containers trying to come over here, said Ian Wiley of the British Garden Center Association. Finally, it was a bad week for denial. After right-wing rocker Ted Nugent, 72, who has called COVID fake and told fans, "I ain't taking no vaccine," announced that he had the disease. COVID, he admitted, had left him so weak and racked with pain for 10 days that he can hardly crawl out of bed, adding, "I thought I was dying." Our briefing article is titled, "China's Designs on Taiwan." Recent belligerent actions raise fears that China may try to seize Taiwan by force. What would happen? What has China been doing? The Chinese military routinely rehearses an invasion of Taiwan and has even created a life-size mock-up of the presidential building for its bombers to practice targeting. Chinese warplanes intrude into Taiwan's airspace so frequently that Taipei, with its much smaller military, cannot afford to scramble its jets in response every time. In the past few months, Beijing has dramatically scaled up these provocations, sending an aircraft carrier group to the island and flying some 25 fighter jets and bombers into Taiwanese airspace in a single day. Because Beijing will host the Winter Olympics in early 2022, few analysts believe an invasion is likely this year. But U.S. military leaders predict a possible takeover attempt within the next 6 years. That would pose a huge problem for the U.S. While Washington severed formal ties with the island in 1979 to establish relations with China and has no defense treaty with Taiwan, a law requires the U.S. to ensure Taiwan can defend itself. President Biden last week dispatched a delegation of U.S. officials to Taipei in a show of support, and Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned that it would be a serious mistake for anyone to try to change the existing status quo by force. Why does China want Taiwan? Lying just 80 miles from the Chinese mainland, Taiwan was part of China for centuries. It was then occupied by Japan from 1895 until the end of World War II. After Mao Zedong and the Chinese Communist Party, the CCP, won China's civil war in 1949, U.S. ally Chiang Kai-shek fled to the island and set up a rival Republic of China. But Beijing has always considered it a renegade province. When the UN admitted China in 1971, it kicked Taiwan out. Ever since, the U.S. has held to a carefully worded doctrine that both sides of the Taiwanese Strait are one China, leaving ambiguous which side is the legitimate government. President Xi Jinping wants his legacy to be the restoration of Greater China, with total control over Taiwan, Hong Kong, and the ethnic minority provinces of Tibet and Xinjiang. He has explicitly threatened the use of force to reclaim Taiwan. Why would the U.S. intervene? For one thing, Taiwan is the world's top maker of advanced semiconductors, and Washington does not want to see Beijing seize control of that critical technology. Then, too, Taiwan is a vibrant democracy in a region that has few. China's recent assertion of control over Hong Kong, which has seen its freedoms drastically curtailed, shows that Taiwan's 24 million people would be badly repressed. For the U.S., losing Taiwan would be a crippling blow to American prestige. To abandon our commitment to Taiwan's de facto independence would be a diplomatic earthquake on par with the 1956 British loss of the Suez Canal, which signaled the end of the empire. China would effectively replace the U.S. as the world's predominant superpower. Why is China acting now? China fears that the goal of reunification may be getting further away. While Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen has not explicitly called for formal independence, something just 32% of Taiwanese would support, she has begun trying to lessen her country's dependence on mainland trade. The U.S. has sold Taiwan billions of dollars worth of weapons over the years, including $5 billion last year alone. And China may feel that the best time to act is soon, before Taipei can strengthen its military. Chinese aggression in other arenas, with little international pushback, has also likely emboldened Chinese military leaders. How would an invasion occur? Beijing could blockade Taiwan, depriving it of oil, gas, and food until it surrenders. Or it could launch a massive surprise attack, overwhelming the island before the U.S. could send help. First, cyberstrikes could cripple U.S. satellites monitoring Chinese missile launches. Then bombers could destroy command centers while paratroopers swooped in to establish a beachhead for tens of thousands of soldiers to land. If the People's Liberation Army got boots on the ground fast, the takeover could be a fait accompli, and the U.S. would face a decision about whether to go to war with a nuclear-armed foe halfway around the world. A military conflict with China, no matter how it ended, would be devastating to both economies, which heavily depend on trade with each other. What are the U.S. options? Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, recommends that the U.S. give an explicit commitment to defend Taiwan militarily in order to deter a Chinese attack. A failed bid to reunify Taiwan with China would severely wound the Communist Party's hold on its people, he said, and that is a risk Xi is unlikely to take. Other analysts recommend that the U.S. station more troops in the region, perhaps even on Taiwan itself, to act as a tripwire, much as the U.S. presence in South Korea deters North Korea. But a slow buildup of U.S. forces in the region might simply trigger Beijing to move against Taiwan immediately. Mass casualties and international condemnation may be a price Xi Jinping is willing to pay, says China expert Ian Easton. We underestimate the Chinese Communist Party's capacity for radical decision-making at our peril. And let's read a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. First one claims, yes, Trump colluded with Russia. The Trump campaign's collusion with Russia was no hoax, said Philip Bump. That's the unmistakable conclusion of a new Treasury Department report on Russia's malign activities, which finally connected a straight line from the Trump campaign to Russian intelligence. Special counsel Robert Mueller had previously discovered that Trump's campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, gave several troves of polling data and campaign strategy in 2016 to Russian intelligence officer Konstantin Kalimnik, a former business partner of Manafort's in Ukraine. The new report confirms for the first time that Kalimnik then turned that data, which included information about swing states, over to the Russian intelligence services for use in their online disinformation campaign to help Donald Trump. A longtime advisor to Kremlin-backed Ukrainians, Manafort originally promised to tell prosecutors what he knew, but reneged after President Trump dangled a pardon at him. That pardon was granted before Trump left the White House, completing a successful cover-up. But now we have confirmation of what has been obvious to anyone not in denial. Trump's campaign did provide direct help to Russia, and Russia used it in its campaign to get Trump elected president. The danger of TV ads for marijuana. Should we ban marijuana ads on TV? Asks Tom Joyce. This is a question we face as 17 states have now legalized recreational marijuana and the push to decriminalize its use spreads. In Colorado, a marijuana dispensary has already launched a TV commercial campaign to promote smoking weed and ingesting it through candy-like edibles, indicating more such ads will be coming in other states. The problem is that ads extolling the pleasures of marijuana use will be seen by children. Despite what advocates say, marijuana is not harmless. Research has shown that regular use of cannabis can increase depression and anxiety, lead to driving accidents, and have negative impacts on the developing brains of teens, perhaps even affecting their IQ. Weed use is already commonplace among adolescents, and TV ads will only serve to make marijuana seem cooler and more attractive. Tobacco advertising has been rightly banned from TV since the 1970s because it clearly glamorized cigarettes and encouraged young people to smoke. Adults can make their own decisions about marijuana, but minors aren't qualified to make informed judgments about its health effects. Without a ban, weed companies will use TV ads to tacitly encourage teens to get high. Our third column comes from Bangladesh. Blighting our most precious resource. Bangladesh is destroying its beautiful rivers, said Araf Momen Aka. We grow up learning that our nation is naturally blessed with a network of waterways that bring silt for farming and support our fishing industry. Yet since gaining independence from Pakistan in 1971, we have lost about 300 of the 700 rivers that used to flow through this country. Some waterways have been filled in by encroachers who illegally build on the banks or polluted so badly that the river cannot flow anymore. Others have been overfished to the point where they can no longer support an ecosystem. For the past 4 years, I've commuted past the once mighty Turag. During that time, I've seen the river lose more than half its width, thanks to filling and the construction of brick kilns and a shipyard. The government is aware of the scale of the disaster because the High Court in 2019 granted Bangladeshi rivers legal personhood and empowered the National River Conservation Commission to protect them. But while the commission can identify by name tens of thousands of land grabbers who have been illegally building or polluting, it lacks the resources to actually enforce the law and punish them. How many more rivers must we lose before we take action? It's time for the last word, our in-depth feature article. This week, the headline is Replacing the Newspaper. As local newspapers shrink or disappear, Next Door is taking their place, said journalist Will Oramus in 10.medium.com. Context, balance, and accountability are missing. 1 year ago, Delaware's second largest school district was in trouble. A failed referendum in 2019 on the heels of state funding cuts 2 years prior had left it staring down a $10 million deficit that raised the specter of teacher layoffs, the end of sports and extracurriculars, and the demise of a promising magnet school program. For a district already pummeled by an exodus of well-off families to private and charter schools, it felt like the type of blow that could echo for generations. Leaders and parent advocates in the district, the Christina School District in Newark, Delaware, had been banking on the referendum to pass. They knew that convincing residents to raise their own property taxes, often on behalf of kids other than their own, was never easy. But they had made what they thought was a compelling case through informational websites, word of mouth, and outreach to local media, the same strategy that had helped them pass a similar measure 3 years earlier. They never expected the campaign would also hinge in part on their ability to counter misinformation on Nextdoor, a platform best known for helping neighbors find a good plumber or a lost cat. At its core, Nextdoor is an evolution of the neighborhood listserv for the social media age, a place to trade composting tips, offer babysitting services, or complain about the guy down the street who doesn't clean up his dog's poop. But it has gradually evolved into something bigger and more consequential than just a digital bulletin board. In many communities, the platform has begun to step into roles once filled by America's local newspapers. In my own city of Newark, Delaware, population 33,000, I've had a front row seat for Nextdoor's emergence as a force in local politics, with a school district referendum as a watershed. As the 2019 referendum approached, I saw Nextdoor posts claiming that the district was squandering money, that its administrators were corrupt, and that it already spent more money per student than certain other districts with higher test scores. The last of those was true, but left out the context that Christina hosts both the state school for the deaf and its largest autism program. District advocates told me later that they had wanted to post counter arguments to the platform, but were hindered by Nextdoor's decentralized structure. You can't view posts from outside your own locale, and there aren't public analytics about what types of posts perform well or poorly. Some district officers couldn't even access the post in discussions about the referendum because the posts were only visible to Newark residents, and their homes are outside the city's borders, as is the district's headquarters, which is actually in nearby Wilmington, Delaware. After the referendum failed, some pointed to misinformation on Nextdoor as a factor in its defeat. As one frustrated parent told the local weekly paper, the Newark Post, "It's hard to combat that if that's where the public is going for information." While social networks such as Facebook and Twitter have faced a litany of scandals, Nextdoor has managed to duck the headlines in congressional hearings. That may be at least partly due to some real virtues of the way it's designed. The network's intimate scope, with each user identified by a real first name, last initial, and neighborhood of residence, can make using Nextdoor feel less like a game of influence and more like, well, actually talking to your neighbors. It's hard to go viral when your audience is limited to your immediate area. Good news, which can be hard to come by on local TV newscast or on the front page of a newspaper, often features prominently on Nextdoor. The most popular posts on my network in recent months have included one from a resident praising a local restaurant for its efforts to feed the hungry on Thanksgiving, and another from a resident who built an elaborate model train display in his window and invited families with kids to stop by to view it as a COVID-safe winter activity. Found pets on Nextdoor seem to be as nearly as common as missing ones. Seniors have been using the app to share tips on where to get their COVID vaccinations. Not all of Nextdoor's effects are so wholesome, however. A closer look reveals several design features that tend to tilt neighborhoods' priorities toward the interests of their squeakiest wheels, sometimes at the expense of their most vulnerable, and sometimes at the expense of truth. Nextdoor seems to be most effective at amplifying well-off residents' quality of life concerns. Posts which are often racially tinged, warn of crime, and suspicious people arrive in Nextdoor feeds devoid of the context that a good local reporter might add, such as putting local crime rates in historical perspective or noting root causes such as unemployment or cuts to social services. That's a problem Nextdoor shares with other hyper-local apps like Citizen and Neighbors, and to be fair, with local TV newscasts, whose unofficial motto a New York Magazine writer once famously skewered is, "If it bleeds, it leads." A problem more specific to Nextdoor is that, even more than some other social networks, the platform makes it hard for users to distinguish truth from untruth. You can post an image, but the majority of posts are text only, and posting a link to another website doesn't unfurl any preview of the headline or image to encourage readers to click through, as Facebook and Twitter do. As a result, facts cited in support of users' opinions often come without citation. Unlike the leading social platforms, which prioritize original posts over the replies or comments, reply threads on Nextdoor form the core of its content. Nextdoor tends to surface and even send push notifications for the posts that are getting the largest volumes of replies, meaning that controversial comments drawing lots of angry rebuttals get amplified. In some ways, Nextdoor is filling a gap left by the dearth of local news outlets. When we were scoping out what does a new desert look like, it was clear there's often a whole group of hyperlocal platforms that we don't traditionally consider to be news, said Emily Bell, director of Toe Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University. Those included Nextdoor, Facebook groups, local Reddit subs, and crime-focused apps such as Citizen and Amazon Ring's Neighbors. In the absence of a traditional news outlet, people do share news. They do comment on news, she said, but they're doing it on a platform like Nextdoor that really is not designed for news. Maybe in the same way that Facebook is not designed for news. Like Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest, Nextdoor makes money by charging businesses to place ads among the posts that appear in users' feeds. More than those other platforms, Nextdoor focuses on local advertisers, including many of the same ones that historically sustained local newspapers. While Nextdoor has not been a main driver of local news decline, Google and Facebook are much bigger culprits, commanding the majority of digital advertising spend. While Craigslist dealt the primary blow to the classified section, its rise is coming at a time when many local papers are teetering on the precipice. Newark isn't a news desert, but it isn't exactly an oasis either. Its only true local news source is the Newark Post, a free weekly paper that employs one full-time journalist to write and edit most of the articles and take photos. It shares a second reporter with another local paper in the same chain. The biggest frustration I have is the power it gives the government, said that single full-time journalist, Post editor Josh Shannon. In the past, he explained, public officials needed local news outlets to get their message out, so they had little choice but to take reporters' calls. That meant accepting that their perspective would form part of the story, but would be fact-checked and brought together with information from other sources that might challenge or contradict the official line. When Shannon covers a major crime or arrest by the Newark police, he'll seek out court records and interview people who knew the suspect and victim, giving him the chance to raise questions about the officer's actions. Now, Shannon said, these social media outlets give governments and police agencies and universities a chance to bypass the media and present their press statements to the public as the whole story, often beating the press to the news. Sociologist Sandra Ball Rokeach, a professor emerita at the University of Southern California Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism, said Nextdoor can play a modest sort of community building role by connecting neighbors around discussions on certain topics. But it's no substitute for local journalism. When people turn to Nextdoor instead of a local paper, Ball Rokeach said, they're getting to know which plumber to hire. They're getting to know the latest controversies on the trailers for homeless people in the park. But they're not getting to know what's really important in terms of the decisions making at multiple level of government and how those decisions are being affected by various different power players. A month after the failed Christina School District referendum in 2019, the school board voted 4-3 to eliminate 63 jobs, with the alternative being bankruptcy and a bid for a state bailout. Some parents gave up hope. A neighbor of mine, who had been among the district's staunch supporters, abruptly sold her house and moved her family to suburban Pennsylvania, where public schools are better funded. Others who could afford it moved their children to private schools, furthering one of the trends that had put the district in a tough spot to begin with. The district and its backers started planning another referendum campaign for 2020, with the stakes now critical. On the chopping block, if they failed again, would be not just teacher and staff jobs, but also after-school sports, extracurriculars, and a nascent award-winning magnet school program. In fact, the school board voted to make all those cuts a month before the referendum in order to balance its budget. Only if it passed would they be reversed. This time, their strategy included arming supporters with facts and counterarguments to post whenever they encountered criticism on their respective Nextdoor networks around the district. There was definitely more of a cohesive effort to provide talking points to community activists, said Claire O'Neill, a parent who won appointment to the school board later that year. As the special election approached, something unexpected happened. Nextdoor threads, 50 and 100 replies long, dug deep into the district's finances, its budgets, administrator salaries, and what the consequences might be if the referendum passed or failed. Unlike the year before, the district's supporters seemed to outnumber its detractors. The discussions were among the hottest topics on Newark area next-door networks, making what would typically be a low-turnout election feel like a high-stakes event, the topic everyone was talking about. On Election Day, June 9th, polling places had lines out the door, a rarity for a single-issue local election. Turnout was unprecedented, nearly doubling that of 2019, and the result was a landslide. Some 70% of voters approved all four funding requests, with more people voting yes than the total number who had voted the year before. Suddenly, the district's future looked hopeful again. Exactly what role Nextdoor played in that dramatic turnaround is hard to disentangle. The option to vote by mail due to COVID-19 may have helped. The sense of urgency for the district certainly did. O'Neill believes the informal Nextdoor information campaign made a difference. The lesson for the district and other public agencies, she believes, is that they can no longer win the battle of public opinion on their own. They have to actively enlist advocates in the community to wage it on their behalf on Nextdoor and other hyper-local online networks. It just requires more of individual citizens, O'Neill said. It's a lot more work because there's just so much information out there, and it's up to you to decide what's right and what's wrong. There's part of that that's beautiful, and there's a part of that that's really scary. This was adapted from an article that first published by 10 on Medium, 10.medium.com. Here's a technology article for you. Flying cars. This time, they may be real. Flying cars are finally moving beyond the realm of science fiction, said The Economist. Midway between a cab and a helicopter, the latest concepts for air mobility aren't quite what the Jetsons had in mind. But thanks to better batteries and lightweight materials, several vehicles, some of them 10 years in the making, are ready to carry passengers. One company, EHang, is already close to certification in China, while more than two dozen are pushing for certification by the Federal Aviation Administration in the United States. Investment is pouring into startups like Joby, which bought Uber's fledgling flying taxi unit in December, and says its five-seater machine will enter commercial service in 2024. Another company, Archer Aviation, has promised its investors flying taxi networks in Los Angeles and Miami within 5 years. The real revolution will come when full autonomy takes out the cost of the pilot, which Archer maintains will happen by 2028. Okay, so the new flying cars don't come with Jetson-style cool bubble tops, said Robert Ito in AltaOnline.com, or fold up into a briefcase, but they do offer a range of modern advantages. Most are fully electric and able to take off and land vertically like a helicopter, eliminating the need for runways. You might even hail one with an app. Think Uber, but for the air. The technology is evolving fast, said John Thornhill in the Financial Times. A recent report from Morgan Stanley pointed out several breakthroughs, such as batteries that promise cheaper cost, greater range, and lower noise. So impressed are the bank's analysts that they suggested air vehicles might one day travel more miles and sell more units than traditional cars. Let's just not lose our heads in the clouds, said Andrew Paul in Input magazine. We've been hearing about flying vehicles since Henry Ford. Technology has obviously improved, but realistically, if any flying cars make it into our daily lives, they'll look like the EHang 184 or 216 models, passenger commuter drones meant to ferry the uber wealthy. It's not clear there's really a market for this, said pilot John Zimmerman in AirFactsJournal.com. The average American drives 29 miles per day, and most of those cannot easily be replaced by flying unless there are thousands of landing spots at every soccer practice and grocery store. Jovi is trying to distinguish itself as more practical than conventional light aircraft, but it still features a 38-foot wingspan, not exactly something you can park at Walmart. But the most significant roadblock to flying cars will be the same one facing helicopters today: neighbors who don't like the idea of an aircraft flying near their house. And on the health and science page, quit the overzealous cleaning. Health officials have a simple message for those people still militantly wiping down every surface to ward off the coronavirus. You can stop now. The Centers for Disease Control has confirmed that risk of surface transmission is considered to be low. Early in the pandemic, researchers warned that the virus might survive for days on plastic and metal, and that people could become infected if they touched a contaminated surface and then their nose, lips, or eyes. But there's now overwhelming evidence that COVID-19 is primarily an airborne disease. So the CDC wants people to abandon so-called hygiene theater and focus on the real threat: the tiny virus-bearing aerosolized droplets that linger in unventilated spaces. Extra disinfecting is now only recommended for schools, homes, and other indoor settings where there has been a suspected or confirmed COVID case within 24 hours. Many scientists have been urging the health agency to revise its guidance for months. I'm kind of wondering what took them so long. Emmanuel Goldman, a microbiologist at Rutgers New Jersey Medical School, tells TheAtlantic.com, "There is so much inertia in the scientific establishment." Why gorillas beat their chests. The chest beating of a male gorilla is often portrayed in the movies as the ultimate threat display. But a new study suggests that the primates actually pound at potential challengers to avoid, not start, a fight. Researchers spent 2 years observing endangered mountain gorillas in Rwanda, witnessing more than 500 displays of chest beating from 25 different males. They recorded the sound frequency, rate, and duration of the pounding and used photographs to measure each animal's shoulder breadth. While there was no relationship between the size of the animals and the number of beats or length of display, the largest specimens did produce lower frequencies than their smaller rivals. The researchers say this shows the chest beating isn't just a visual display, but an honest signal of competitive ability, allowing the gorillas to size each other up without getting violent. Even if you're likely to win a fight, there's still quite a high risk factor. Lead author Edward Wright from the Max Planck Institute in Germany tells National Geographic, "These are large, powerful animals that can do a lot of damage." And flipping over to the Talking Points page, we'll start with an article titled, "Russia: Putin's free pass is canceled." President Biden has sent a message to Russia, said Frieda Gittes in CNN.com. "The acquiescent days of the Trump administration are over." Last week, Biden slapped a slew of sanctions on Moscow that target 46 individuals, entities, and companies, and ban U.S. banks from buying Russian debt directly from its government, which will hobble Moscow's ability to borrow money and will further damage its economy. 10 Russian diplomats suspected of spying were ejected from the U.S., but with tensions between the U.S. and Russia about as high as they've been at any time since the Cold War, Biden invited Russian President Vladimir Putin to a summit to prevent further escalation. "The sanctions are well-deserved and come at the right time," said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. "Russia's massive SolarWinds hack infiltrated U.S. government agencies, and Putin's top political opponent, Alexei Navalny, is near death in a penal colony. Meanwhile, Russia is massing 100,000 troops on the Ukrainian border, and its intentions remain unclear." "The administration may have called the sanctions sweeping," said the Washington Post in an editorial, "but punches were definitely pulled. The penalties do not target the foundations of Putin's power, the energy and mineral firms that bring in the majority of Russia's wealth, and the several dozen oligarchs who prop up the regime and manage the president's personal wealth. In fact, these penalties on Russian aggression don't even address the allegations that Putin authorized the placement of bounties on American service members fighting in Afghanistan. There's an excellent reason Biden did not include the alleged bounties, said Michael Brendan Doherty in NationalReview.com. Intelligence services are now saying they have only low to moderate confidence that the bounties ever existed. But real or not, they've already served their purpose by being leaked to embarrass former President Trump before the election. Russia's many hostile acts are certainly real, and Biden's sanctions are a good step, said David Andelman in NBCNews.com. But to face down Putin's ambitions, the president needs to take much stronger actions. Biden should press our allies to invite Ukraine into the NATO fold, and he should fortify the country with the sort of heavy-duty offensive equipment it needs to put down a Russian-supported separatist revolt. It's time we treated Ukraine like a real ally. Refugees, Biden's flip-flop. On immigration issues, President Biden is having a hard time pleasing anyone, said Jonathan Allen in NBCNews.com. Biden pulled an abrupt flip-flop on refugee policy last week, announcing plans to keep in place a draconian Trump administration cap on refugee admissions, then backtracking hours later under heavy pressure from fellow Democrats and human rights activists. For four decades, the U.S. has annually admitted and resettled an average of 78,000 carefully screened refugees from the Middle East, Africa, and around the world who faced political or religious persecution. Biden initially promised to raise Trump's cap of 15,000 refugees for this fiscal year to 62,500, but got cold feet, reportedly out of concern that Americans will conflate refugees with the migrants flooding the southern border. While Biden has now pledged to increase the limit, it's unclear how far he'll go. On the fraught issue of immigration, Biden is struggling to find a position that satisfies his base and doesn't alienate centrist voters. Biden's flip-flopping shows he's as incompetent as he is cowardly, said Beckett Adams in WashingtonExaminer.com. His initial willingness to maintain a cap he previously blasted as immoral confirms he's a liar who's fully prepared to break major campaign promises. And his subsequent walk back showed he's cowed easily by party opinion. At the current pace, Biden will admit just 4,100 refugees this year, the lowest number in decades, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. While Biden dithers, thousands of fully vetted refugees fleeing violence and persecution are stuck in limbo abroad, some of whom have waited patiently for years. The question facing Biden is simple, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Will he muster the courage of his convictions? Perhaps he should review the clear-eyed pronouncements of his campaign in which he spoke of our humanitarian obligation to those who see this country as a beacon. Trump very openly sought to engineer a wider America through immigration restrictions, said Adam Serwer in TheAtlantic.com. To restore the soul of the nation, as candidate Biden promised, means not just deposing Trump, but restoring America as a place where refugees can come, find freedom, and contribute to American society, as generations of refugees have done before them. If Biden keeps the door shut, he has restored little more than Democratic control of the presidency. And we'll read a few of the shorter notes, starting with, at least 15 police officers have shot a suspect after mistaking their sidearm for a taser or other stun gun. Five of the 15 officers were indicted. In three cases, including the only two in which suspects died, the officer was found guilty of a crime. More than 87,000 Americans died of drug overdoses between September 2019 and September 2020, a 29% jump from the previous 12 months, and the highest number since the opioid epidemic began in the 1990s. The biggest increase came in April and May, when many treatment programs and support centers closed or cut back services. The number of children seeking treatment at hospital emergency rooms after ingesting their parents' edible marijuana products has soared as pot has been legalized in many states, hitting 554 last year, up from 19 in 2010. High levels of THC, the active ingredient in marijuana, can lead to dangerous side effects in kids, including trouble breathing and seizures. We had several good quotes this week, so I'm going to read two of them for you. We'll start with one from David Foster Wallace, who says, "The truth will set you free, but not until it's finished with you." And the always quotable Mark Twain says, "If you pick up a starving dog and make him prosperous, he will not bite you. This is the principal difference between a dog and a man." And with that, we have run out of time for today's program. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.